They will flip the switch on the state Christmas tree tonight, 7 p.m. There was, of course, a torrent of rain that interrupted the celebration before the lighting on Friday. It interrupted WKAR-TV's live broadcast. Oh, well, the weather will be better next year. You can never predict the weather this time of year. This is probably the most unpredictable time of year. It's apt to be anything. It's apt to be tropical. It's apt to be frigid. It's apt to be rain or snow or just about anything. But they reset it for 7 p.m. tonight. Caroling led by Taylor Taylor. Lansing Mayor Virge Bernero will be there. Dick Pefley will be there, of course, the kingpin of the Electric Light Parade and the Board of Water and Light. Matt White of the Michigan Capital Commission. So 7 o'clock tonight. You can reschedule your plans for that. It'll be interesting to see how many people make that tonight. I'm Mark Bayshore. This is Current State here on WKAR. Thank you for joining us. 2 weeks after a stunning presidential election, Democrats are evaluating their missteps over the last few months and looking to make a fresh start on the road to the 2018 elections. Here in Michigan, a state which saw its closest ever presidential contest, Democrats are retooling their core message and building a plan to win back many of their core voters who broke ranks and voted for Donald Trump. Joining me now in the studio to talk about the Michigan Democratic Party's plans for the future is its chairman, Brandon Dillon. Brandon, welcome to Current State.
Well, thank you for having me.
There have been a lot of theories put out there since the election about why Hillary lost, why Democrats failed to take back the Congress and the Michigan House. Give us your assessment. What do you think went wrong?
Well, I'll be very blunt. They got more votes than Michigan.
You're good.
You know, there's a few things I think that we need to look at, and you know, we're going through a process of really analyzing the data and talking to folks about the message and field and all the other components of a campaign. But I think at the end of the day, the first takeaway is that you know Donald Trump was able to essentially hijack a message that Democrats have been delivering for a long time about protecting the working class, middle class, trying to make sure that we were counterbalancing the power from people at the top, and delivered it more effectively despite the, you know, the racist, sexist kind of language that he was using. I think there was enough voters out there who are frustrated with the way Washington's been working or not working, and just said, "Look, we're gonna go with this and see what happens. It can't be any worse than what we've seen so far." And we have to, I think, get bogged down in trying to make the election all about why Donald Trump wasn't fit to be president, instead of what plans and policies Hillary Clinton and the rest of the Democratic ticket would do to make people's lives better. So getting back to our core message and how we appeal to a broad swath of the electorate, whether it's white working class voters, Latino voters, African American voters, young voters, who are concerned about the way the system is currently structured, I think is important for us to consider as we go forward.
Well, just an hour earlier this morning here, we heard David Brock on NPR. Mr. Brock is the founder of two progressive super PACs, and the point was raised with David Green of NPR that Democrats have to do. I mean, Mr. Trump apparently did really well, or better than expected, I should say, with the white working class. Talk to us specifically about that. You alluded to that in your answer, but is that on your short list of concerns next time around?
Well, certainly. We don't want to concede the vote of any group of voters out there. And, you know, I think we need to be cognizant as well about the national Democratic message, which seems to not be as which seems to resonate with a lot of people, frankly. I mean, Hillary Clinton will end up winning probably over 2 million more votes than Donald Trump across the country, but that does little to affect the presidential race when we can't carry states like Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, where you have a lot of these. I think we're lumping a bunch of people into this, but white working class voters, people who are feel that the system isn't working. I think a lot of these voters, we're going to find out, are very similar to the kind of folks that turned out for Ross Perot in the early 90s and in the times that he ran for president. So But I think it would be mistaken just to try to cater a message directly to these folks. This is not really about identity politics as much as it is about, you know, which party or which candidate do people think is actually willing to take on the system and get at campaign finance reform, tax reform, amending trade deals, investing in things that actually put people to work. And folks didn't either buy what we were selling or thought that Donald Trump could deliver on those. And the bad news for the Republicans is, you know, they have total control. There's a lot of promises made. We're going to try to keep him accountable to those promises. But he's said that he would deliver a lot, and he was the only one who can do it. We'll see if he's able to.
We're talking with Michigan Democratic Party Chairman Brandon Dillon on WKAR's Current State. How would you assess Hillary Clinton's ground game here in Michigan up before the election?
Yeah, I actually think that the ground game itself was pretty effective. There was, you know, over 200 staff on the ground, had been here since July, and targeting voters across the state. I think strategically, we have to look at going forward the kind of voters we're talking to on a consistent basis. I think there's been a focus, not just with the Clinton campaign, but other Democratic campaigns in the last few cycles, on really just trying to turn out our base and not talking to those voters who don't necessarily look like solid Democratic voters, but are persuadable. But in terms of the mechanics, I think the campaign ran very well. I think the message that was being delivered was not resonating with those swing voters and those others that came out, particularly in some of the rural areas. But, you know, I think the ground game was executed very well, but I think the strategy of only talking to base voters and not expanding the universe of people that you're calling on the phone or knocking on their doors is something that we have to really look at going forward, because we obviously, I don't think our base is big enough to be able to just rely on and getting those people out to vote.
But isn't the bottom line, though, fewer African-American Democrats, fewer Democratic millennials turned out in Michigan as in 2012? I mean, I know you're yeah. downplaying the role of identity politics here, but that's got to be a concern, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I think there's been a lot made of the vote in Detroit, but frankly, the Detroit vote was not significantly off of where it was expected to be. There's been a lot of population loss in the city, and folks have moved into some of the inner ring suburbs and other areas. So it's hard to look at Detroit as just an entity unto itself without understanding that a lot of voters who may have lived there, been registered there, have moved out to other areas. But look, you had almost 100,000 undervotes at the presidential race, people who came out and vote but then did not vote in the presidential contest. I think that's something we have to understand, that, you know, it's about turnout, it's about getting our base out, but to believe that the only way you get your base out is by having a field operation, I think flies in the face of everything we've seen this cycle and in a couple cycles before, that the best predictor of turnout is people's motivation to vote and feeling like their vote matters. And we've got to get a handle on the message and make sure that the messenger is right. And then I think that really drives what we do in the field.
To what extent did the Michigan Democratic Party help the Clinton campaign? How much did they rely on you?
Well, our role after the primary was really more of a supportive role. The Clinton campaign, you know, came in, they ran essentially their own operation. We helped help them put that together. We worked very closely with them to make sure that we identified the offices space that they would need and helped them recruit volunteers. But this was, you know, this was their plan. It was their strategy, and we were here to help implement that. We did go out, and when there were things that we didn't think were being done to the level we thought they should be, went out and, you know, raised money to help supplement those efforts. But the Clinton campaign, as opposed to the Trump campaign, which really relied on state parties and the national party, was driven by Brooklyn.
Donald Trump's use of Twitter really dominated to some, drove, I would say largely, significantly drove the news cycle every day. Is the Michigan Democratic Party reassessing the role of social media in election success, electoral success?
Yeah, I would caution against drawing too many conclusions or trying to figure out how you would replicate what Donald Trump did on Twitter going forward. I think he is he's a unique candidate, to put it mildly. I do think the media and others are going to have a real challenge in trying to cover him going forward. We've seen in the last couple weeks since he's been president-elect that his Twitter messages seem to dominate the news cycle, which can sometimes be a distraction from the pretty serious things that are going on with his appointments and potential conflicts of interest already. So I think the old rules of how you cover a president or a presidential candidate are going to have to be reexamined, given the way that Mr. Trump, President-elect Trump, has been using social media, frankly, I think, to distract and get a lot of attention and take people's eye off the ball on what's really important, which is our policies, appointments, and the way he's going to conduct himself in terms of ethics as president.
Very interesting thoughts there. We're talking about the Michigan Democratic Party and its strategy during the presidential election and its future. Looking forward to the 2018 midterms, my guest is the party chairman, Brandon Dillon. In 2018, our top three state officers, governor, attorney general, and secretary of state, all Republicans, will be ending their terms. It's widely expected that Attorney General Bill Schuette will run for governor. How do you begin to prepare a message to counter whomever the GOP puts up this far in advance? Is that taking shape?
Well, I think we're looking at, first of all, what our message has been and how we can make that stronger going forward in Michigan. I think you're going to see in 2018, Republicans have had total control. We've had total control of state government for at least 8 years at that point. And the same frustrations that drove people to feel that Washington was not delivering, that, to borrow a phrase, which I think was not necessarily indicative of what's going on, but to drain the swamp in Washington. I mean, there is a similar dynamic going on in Michigan, where you have a government, you have an attorney general, you have a governor that have been really serving people at the top. And I think you're going to see a sharp focus on what Democrats, not only the ones running for governor, attorney general, and secretary of state, but all on the ticket, will do to reform the system to make it work for working people, average middle-class families, and others. But we've got to tighten that message, and we've got to make sure we provide not just a critique of what's happened in the last 8 years, but a positive alternative to show what we would do differently. And it's a challenge. Attorney General Schuette is a very slick politician. He's known for changing his positions, much like Donald Trump, to suit whichever audience he's talking to. So we're going to have to be very smart about how we direct our campaigns. But I think we'll have the off-year election normally is a referendum on the party in power and the president at the time. So, like I said, they've got the keys to this car and are driving along and have made a lot of promises in Michigan and nationally. And we're going to be there to hold them accountable, but to also offer a vision of how things can be better.
Let me follow up on that last point you just made. How you believe then that the Trump administration's performance, good or bad, could impact the vote in Michigan in 2018? Trump fares badly, then Schuette, as a supporter of Trump, also that has a negative impact on him.
Yeah, we've seen. I mean, if you look back at many of the off-year elections, 2014, 2010, 2006. You have seen that the party in power usually takes the party in power, meaning the party that holds the White House, has taken a beating with to put it mildly, in off-year elections. In 2006, it was George W. Bush who was president, and there was a real negative reaction to things that he had done. In 2010 and 2014, President Obama's popularity and favorable ratings were in the tank, and Democrats across the country, not just in Michigan, suffered for us. So increasingly these elections are being nationalized. There is still a strong local and state component, but if the environment is one where people are dissatisfied and wanting to send a message to whoever is the occupant of the White House, that can have some real dramatic effects down the ticket in terms of motivation and whose base is ready to get out and vote.
How strong do you feel Democratic candidates will be in 2018? I know you can't entirely anticipate that, but I mean, there are some big names that have been batted around: Gretchen Whitmer, Dan Kildee. Generally, Brandon, how strong do you feel Democratic candidates will be in 2018?
Well, the good news for Democrats is, you know, we had a tough year. We had a tough election night. But looking forward to 2018, we have incredibly strong, qualified, smart candidates who have either expressed an interest in running for governor or whose names have been mentioned. We're also going to have, I think, an opportunity to have candidates for the Secretary of State, Attorney General, and Supreme Court who are extremely qualified. It's not going to be a matter of trying to find people to run this year. We have people chomping at the bit to go out and run and change the direction of the state because they really are frustrated with the way that Governor Snyder and Attorney General Schuette have done things with Flint water crisis, with Detroit, with the kind of scandals you've seen around some of the insider dealing and contracts for office buildings and lack of ethics and transparency. We're going to have a very strong ticket in 2018, and I think this is going to be a sign of a very healthy party to have a competitive race for these offices.
We've been talking about the Michigan Democratic Party and its plans for the next 2 years heading into the 2018 midterms. Brandon Dillon is a former state representative and currently the state party chairman. Brandon Dillon, thank you for taking time for us today.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
Coming up on Current State: City of East Lansing workers have been busy counting deer this month. Are there too many? Are there not enough? We'll ask the city's Environmental Services Administrator what they learned from the head and antler count and how that helps East Lansing residents. That's coming up on Current State. Well, who didn't feel it when they woke up this morning? Thanksgiving is right around the corner. It's a good feeling. For many families, Thanksgiving is the biggest food-centered event of the year. Lots of planning goes into the menu, and pre-planning can make your day in the kitchen go smoothly and yield the best results. In recent years, MSU Culinary Services corporate chef Kurt Kwiatkowski has given us new Thanksgiving ideas for old favorites like stuffing and cranberries. This year, we weren't able to record a kitchen session with Kurt because he's been recovering from knee surgery, but he's here live in the studio with us today, ready and raring to go with ideas for pleasing everybody at the table on Thursday. Thank you for coming in, Kurt.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Glad you're feeling better.
Me too.
Everything starts with the bird, right? I mean, with Thanksgiving just 2 days away, what are your thoughts on getting the best turkey that you can?
You know, hopefully you pre-ordered it, and there are plenty of great local farmers that are growing turkeys. Or, you know, if you're going to go to your store, get your turkey, make sure it's thawed. It takes a couple of days to thaw those rock-hard birds. And then it goes into the brine. I think the brine that is something people always forget, and it gives you a lot of leeway because that white meat can get really, really dry quickly. It cooks slower than the dark meat, or the dark meat takes longer to cook than the white meat. And so you got to be really careful in how you're cooking it. So if you can brine that bird for, you know, 6 to 12 hours, it's going to give you a buffer zone and help you make that turkey turn out super, super moist and delicious.
For the uninitiated, what is brining?
A brine would be a solution that has a lot of salt in it and then aromatics. And so we're using basically osmosis to have that salt along with honey and lemon and thyme and some rosemary and maybe a little bit of garlic pull some of those flavors into the turkey. And it's making it a water solution, so it's kind of plumping the turkey up a little bit.
Is it hard to do,
no,
generally?
No. Super easy to do it. You know, it's just, you're looking at basically, I prefer kosher salt, so 1 gallon of water to 1 cup of kosher salt, and then some honey, lemon, thyme, and you mix that up, get that salt dissolved, pour that on the turkey. Make sure it's cold when it goes on the turkey, but pour it on the turkey and let it sit 6 to 12 hours, and magically you've got a nice plump bird that's ready to get cooked.
So as late as 6 hours before the turkey goes into the oven, you've still got an opportunity to brine?
Absolutely.
Okay. Are you planning to do anything new in your kitchen this year?
I'm always playing around with vegetables. I think vegetables are fascinating, and sides to me is what makes Thanksgiving. And so I'm always trying to bring some new, different recipes and different ideas, some of them a little bit out there, but always still fun to the Thanksgiving table.
I sometimes think that nutritionally, if we took vegetables half as seriously the rest of the year as we do on Thanksgiving, then the nutritional profile of the American people would go through the roof. But once a year doesn't get it done. But it's once is better than not at all, mm-hmm. I guess. You like root vegetables. You do like some alternative kinds of vegetables.
Yeah.
What's the appeal there for you?
You know, for me, it's something you can get all year round, especially here in Michigan. You know, it's a storage crop, the beets, the turnips, the rutabagas. I think they have so much flavor and they have so much flexibility to them. And I kind of have my own idea that I want to get people to like beets. Because when I was growing up as a kid, beets out of a can were just so nasty.
Oh, yeah.
They were awful, right? And when I finally had that beet experience where you're like, these can be delicious. Wow. And so I've made it a mission to try and do some fun things with beets.
Searching WKAR.org for the word Thanksgiving, I want to point this out to our listeners. You'll get lots of stories for the holidays, including your previous visits with us on WKAR and some of your recipes. Last year, you prepared a nice stuffing that included Italian sausage. So I want our listeners to keep that in mind. We are getting Thanksgiving cooking tips from MSU Culinary Services corporate chef Kurt Kwiatkowski. We joke at our house that bread is one of the major food groups. So let's talk bread, or more specifically, let's talk dinner rolls. Do they get short shrift? I mean, lots of people are so tied up with the turkey and maybe the side dishes, they rely on store-bought rolls. How do you navigate that?
Oh, I honestly, we usually don't even put the dinner rolls out, so they get, you know, nixed from my Thanksgiving. Inevitably, though, but probably my favorite rolls.
A lot of people love them, though. I mean, for a lot of people, they take it seriously.
One of my favorite ones are Parker House rolls, you know, an English roll with the salt on top, so they're nice and light and fluffy and crusty on the outside and, you know, nicely butter brushed, and those things are delicious.
Are you serious about gravy?
Oh, yes, okay. Very much so.
How do you, is it a more conventional approach, or do you go about it outside the mainstream?
I kind of keep it simple. You know, you've got these beautiful juices that came from the turkey. So after it's cooked, and another key is don't cut the bird right away after it comes out of the oven, right? So we always want to let that meat rest. And while that bird's resting, you take everything, the aromatics and the things you were cooking the turkey in and those juices, and you put those into a pan, you start reducing that down a little bit of a slurry, which would be cornstarch and cold water. You add that in there with maybe a little bit of lemon and a little more butter. You've got some of the best delicious turkey gravy you're gonna find.
Back to the dinner rolls here. Is it a bad idea to try taking on dinner rolls from scratch with everything else that's going on?
Well, it depends upon how much oven space you have. You got to be smart about how you're going to plan this all out. You know, maybe you're going to warm the oven up first and bake off some rolls, and then the turkey goes in. That'd be a good way to do it. I'd want to make sure that you had enough oven space and it's something you've done before. Trying a new recipe for the first time for family, it could get you flustered. This is supposed to be about celebrating and having fun. So hopefully it doesn't stress you out. And so if baking bread's a normal thing, go for it. Have fun, enjoy it. And you know, everybody, I'm sure, will love the fact that you got this fresh baked bread right out in front of you. Mm. But if not, I'd steer clear.
What about appetizers? We're jumping all over the place here, so apologies to our listeners. We're kind of bopping all over the place. Well, do you have appetizers ideas? I mean, they can really enhance the whole experience, the right appetizer.
Oh, yeah. You know, and I think that's another area where you can inject some vegetables, something simple, something light, something that's not going to take you too long to do, some, you know, fresh fruit. Vegetable crudité, something as simple as that, to just put out just a little bit of snacks here and there, some lightly salted nuts. I like to keep things simple and not getting too crazy. If you want to get a little bit fun, you can buy those little fresh mozzarella balls, the bocconcinis. You can buy them even at Meijer. You put that with a grape tomato and a little bit of balsamic vinegar and maybe a little piece of basil on there, put it on a stick. You got a beautiful little appetizer that takes you next to no time to put together.
Something we should also touch on today, food safety issues, maybe during prep and during the meal, but also after the meal. We look forward to the leftovers, but care needs to be taken that those leftovers don't make us sick.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And we don't want to get anyone sick. So when you're working with raw food, work with the raw food, then get it all cleaned up. Clean it up, you know, soap it down, get it cleaned, get your utensils cleaned. Reset the stage to then prep and move on. And when you're putting things away in the cooler or in your refrigerator after you're done with the meal, make sure you're not sealing those bags. Make sure there's some breathing room because you're going to get that condensation built up. And if that food can't cool down quick enough, it has the potential to have a foodborne illness.
In your role as MSU chef, are you working on Thanksgiving, or are you lucky enough to enjoy the day off?
I feel incredibly lucky. I've got, you know, one of the best jobs in the world, in my personal opinion, working for the best university in the world, and they give me the nice liberty to have that day off and spend it with family.
MSU Culinary Services Corporate Chef Kurt Kwiatkowski. You're becoming a fixture on Thanksgiving here on Current State. Kurt, we're really happy about that. Happy Thanksgiving. Thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Happy Thanksgiving to you and everyone else.
Coming up on Current State, we'll visit a pink and purple castle at the Riverwalk Theater for the opening of a new musical, The Princess Who Saved Herself. And we'll meet the author of this premiere production, as well as the Chippewa junior high schooler who had to learn to play guitar so she could also play the princess. That and lots more on the way on Current State. State on 90.5 WKAR, your NPR station. I'm Mark Bayshore. Every Tuesday, Current State reports on the environment. It's firearm deer season in Michigan. Thousands of hunters are in the woods hoping to take down a buck, but my next two guests have a different perspective on deer. In East Lansing, municipal employees have been busy this month counting the number of deer in the city. That data help it to manage the deer population and control the environmental impact that deer can have. Here to discuss East Lansing's deer count and why it's important, Kathy DeChambeau, Environmental Services Administrator for the City of EL. Welcome, Kathy.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you for having us.
Certainly. Also, Sarah Plantrich, an intern with the city's Department of Public Works, who's worked on the deer count. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Describe for us what you've been up to here in November. How exactly do you execute a responsible deer count?
Yeah, sure. So this year we've gone and sampled a total of 16 sites throughout the city in 8 separate parks within the city. We surveyed at Abbott Road Park, White Park, Harrison Meadows, Henry Fine, Bertram Park, as well as this year we added 3 new parks, which were Patriarch Park, Emerson Park, and then the woodlot behind the public library in the East Lansing High School. And so how we went about this survey Was that we had a bunch of volunteers from Michigan State University come out, and we were all of them were assigned a specific location in these parks where they had to sit for 2 hours, and they were just instructed to kind of sit there, and any deer that happened to walk within view of them, they were to write down what time they saw, as well as whether it was a buck or a doe or maybe a yearling.
Mm-hmm.
And then we kind of gathered all the information that way.
How many people are out there counting altogether?
Yeah, so we had MSU, so we had all of our volunteers from the Fisheries and Wildlife Club of MSU, and we had 21 volunteers come out this year. So we had a nice large group of volunteers, which was very helpful. And they went out in the early mornings, evenings. They even gave up time on their weekends to help out with the survey. So we were really appreciative of that.
Why is this important? Why is it important to know the exact number of deer in the city of East Lansing or anywhere?
Right. So finding the exact number of deer would be very ideal. However, it's not very realistic. I wish it was that easy, but it's not. And so our survey was designed to find the minimum estimate of how many deer are in the parks. And by finding the minimum estimate of how many deer there are, then we can kind of go from there and judge on how we want to properly manage that. So we can tell things whether there's deer vehicle collisions based on how many deer there are, or if there's a spike in the number of complaints about deer eating their citizens' plants or anything like that. We can tell just by knowing how many deer there are in the city, kind of gives us a base estimate for how to manage the deer, whether that's lowering speed limits or adding more deer crossing signs or encouraging landowners to plant non-palatable plants for deer so that way their vegetables don't get browsed upon.
Kathy DeChambeau, you take a really targeted focus, obviously. You're sending counters out there to very specific locations. Talk to us about that. Are those locations where all the deer in East Lansing are, or the great majority of them are?
Right, correct. So not necessarily. What we did is we looked very early on. Back in about 2012, we started correlating where we were getting citizen complaints from, where we were getting deer sightings and people sending us emails or saying, you know, I'm kind of concerned about this area, and correlating it to some management areas. And so we looked at pretty much five primary areas in the city where we were actually getting some complaints from residents. And we said, well, let's take a look at what's going on there. And I think the work that Sarah and the Fisheries Club has been doing for us for the last couple of years is just really crucial to understanding what does the deer population look like in East Lansing, and what are the appropriate responses to that population in order to maintain resident satisfaction? So certainly we have residents who are very happy to see deer and like to see deer, even don't mind seeing deer coming into their yards. We have residents who have a completely different reaction to that, who say, no, they're very destructive. I don't want them in my yard. I don't really care if I see them in the park system or see them out in nature. It's not something that I'm interested in. And so trying to manage the expectations of residents when you have sort of, a group of residents who think it's part of nature and really enjoy seeing those animals out there, and a group of residents who see the other side and see that, you know, maybe it's a more destructive part of nature that they really don't want mm-hmm. in their yards. And so, you know, we really want to understand what that population is, what that population is doing over time. If we're starting to see spikes in that population, and especially if those spikes are correlating with deer vehicle accidents, mm-hmm. or we're seeing correlations with increased resident concerns in certain parts of the city, that's something that we need to address and we need to look at.
Is your responsibility strictly to arrive at a number or series of numbers, or do you gather any more information than that? Do you learn about, say, chronic wasting disease or anything else in this process?
Right. It's really, you know, there's just not a magic answer here, and there's not a magic number. It's really a complicated approach that takes time, and it takes a lot of community input. We spent a lot of time since 2012 attending neighborhood association meetings and talking about this subject. We've done multiple surveys to residents. We have a deer management page on our city's website where residents can go and they can get tips on gardening and how to deter deer from their lawns and their landscaping and their gardens. They can also get information about chronic wasting disease, and our concerns obviously being sort of surrounded by areas that have had positive cases of chronic wasting disease, we're very concerned about that, and we want to make sure that if we are going to have a deer population within our city, you certainly want it to be a healthy population, so we want to manage it from that aspect too. So there are so many parts of this puzzle that go together and that we're trying to keep in place and trying to manage with the input of our residents and understanding what our residents want and what they think is successful management. I think that ultimately you have two things going on. You have biological carrying capacity. So what can the ecosystem, what can the parks withstand in terms of a deer population? What will keep that deer population healthy and yet keep the park system healthy and the vegetation healthy there? You also have the social carrying capacity. What is the tolerance of our residents for deer in our city? You know, what is it that, do they like it? Do they want to see deer? Do they not want to see deer? Mm-hmm. So what is that capacity? And I think it's not a magic number, but when you tip those capacities in any direction that overwhelmingly negative,
you learn real fast.
You will know. Yeah. And that's really when we have to start targeting a more tailored response to it.
We're discussing East Lansing's November deer count, why it's important. And joining me, Kathy DeChambeau, Environmental Services Administrator for the City of East Lansing. Also, Sarah Plantrich, an intern with the city's Department of Public Works. Have you had a chance to analyze any of the data you've come up with the last few weeks?
We haven't. So we did just recently finish our surveys. We just finished the beginning of this past week. And so we are still going through and trying to figure out exactly how many deer there are, because there are times when we had multiple students or volunteers, I suppose, in one park at the same time. And we wanted to make sure that they weren't double counting deer. So we want to make sure we have an accurate representation of the deer.
Who processes the data?
So we have partners with the USDA as well as faculty members at Michigan State University that we've kind of send our findings on to them. And then they're the professionals who kind of analyze all the data and give it back to us. We also have been talking with the DNR who give us their input on it, as well as other kind of cities who have been through similar situations regarding deer management.
Kathy, you talked about you know when the scales tip too far one way or the other with regard to social carrying capacity and ecological carrying capacity. Before this year, where was East Lansing at? Was East Lansing risking the balance going too far in one direction or the other? Or would you say there is a good balance in these locations?
Well, Mark, a couple of things. I would say we've been very, very fortunate that back in around 2012, 2013, we realized, you know, we're a fairly medium-sized city. We don't necessarily have the resources on staff for this particular situation. I mean, a lot of medium-sized cities are not going to have a deer specialist or someone like that on staff. So you really need to reach out and look for partners to help you through this process. And so we're so fortunate to be obviously the home of Michigan State University and to have experts at the university that could help us. So we reached out to Jordan Burroughs and Dr. Rick Campa and really started conversations with them about, you know, what kind of data should we be collecting? What should we be looking at when we do community meetings? What kind of information should we try to gather from the community to help inform our decision making? And what kind of information should we impart to the community to help them in their own situation? And what are some steps we can take? We also were able to reach out to the DNR and to USDA Wildlife Services. So all of those partners have been helping us with the protocol for counting deer, for collecting data, for making decisions. They've been really, really helpful. And so we've already taken some actions based on things that we knew within the city. One of those actions we took a couple years ago is we instituted an ordinance that bans feeding of deer. That's really important because when you have parks that are located in residential areas, East Lansing is full of neighborhoods and neighborhood parks. And even our bigger parks are surrounded by residential areas. If people are feeding deer in their backyards, they're drawing the deer through other yards, through places that you really don't want the deer to be in. So that's been really important to us. We also set ourselves up last year to, in the event that we did want to have some kind of cull, some kind of professional cull, that we changed our ordinance so that that can happen by approval of the city council. So if we find ourselves in a situation where we say, you know what, the time has come and we have to do some things here, we have the ability to do that now with the approval of our city council.
You've got a web link where residents can keep up with your activities, cityofeastlansing.com/deer management?
Yes.
Do I have that right?
Yes.
Okay, very good. So once you've had a chance to crunch the numbers, I'm sure the results and any actions you might recommend will be at that site. We want to thank our guests, Kathy DeChambeau, Environmental Services Administrator, City of East Lansing, and thanks to Sarah Plantrich, an intern. We've been talking about the city's recent deer count. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
And Current State discusses Michigan's environment every Tuesday. Our segments and others about the Great Lakes environment can be found at WKAR.org and at GreatLakesEcho.org. The Riverwalk Theater brings a modern and brainy twist on those classic fairy tales about princesses, witches, and dragons this Friday. The show is called The Princess Who Saved Herself, and Current State's Jamie Paisley joins me now after attending the first rehearsal at the Riverwalk. Jamie, I understand the story was inspired by a rock song.
Well, yeah, Mark. I mean, the creator of the musical, Edric Hallin, he expanded the story from a very kind of short rock song, or as Edric tells me, a geek rock song, by the nerdcore songsmith Jonathan Colton. Now, what do those nerd and geek terms mean?
Nerdcore or geek rock is probably something that was pioneered by Jonathan Colton back when he quit his job as a computer programmer and said, I'd like to try writing music. And he devoted a year of his life to turning out a song a week. He called it Thing a Week. And he pretty much stayed on schedule. And one of the first songs that caught people's notice was a song called Code Monkey. And he also did a soft rock remix of Sir Mix-a-Lot's Baby Got Back, which got a lot of internet notice and eventually got stolen by Glee. Eventually, I became aware of it when I was doing a search for the Mandelbrot set, and turns out that he had a song called Mandelbrot Set, and it popped up, and I played it, and I was like, oh, that's interesting. And then I was sharing that around with some of my geek friends from the MSU days, and one of them, a guy named Rob, who lives out in Chicago, said, I actually knew about this Jonathan Colton guy because he has this song called Code Monkey, and in it there's a boring manager, Rob, and my colleagues all brought this song to my attention, so I went and sought out Code Monkey, and then I was kind of hooked, and then I started going through more of his discography and becoming more and more acquainted as I went along.
Which lends itself then to finding the princess who saved herself, which runs about 220, 230 in length. But how long is the stage version that you've written?
It'll be a little over an hour. It won't go over 75 minutes, even with the intermission.
I'm assuming it's not 25 times of the same song over and over. How do you expand that with the different verses that are in the original song?
Well, you start with the original song and flesh out the universe. We actually don't hear the entire song until the finale. The finale is the Jonathan Colton song performed on stage by the band that calls themselves the Kingdom of the Princess Who Saved Herself. At the beginning, we hear the first verse played by the troubadour to set the stage, and we meet the princess, who I decided to name Zoe. If you want to know what Jonathan Colton and Greg Pak named her, then go to the graphic novel that they did on Kickstarter and see the multisyllabic name that they chose for the princess themselves. But I just call her Zoe.
Everybody knew the story of the princess who saved herself.
When I presented myself to the Riverwalk Play Selection Committee back in November or January, whenever it was, the first question was, okay, this girl is supposed to be 7. She's supposed to be multiracial. She's supposed to be comfortable carrying a snake. She's supposed to be able to sing. She's supposed to be able to act. She's supposed to be able to play the electric guitar. Where are you going to find this girl? And it was absolutely the right question to ask right at the outset, and I responded in two parts. First, I said, I only need one. And then I proceeded to explain how I was going to send emails to the music teachers in the various school districts and the community music school and the other institutions out here that have interactions with young kids. And Isabella showed up to auditions, and the only thing that I had to compromise on was instead of 7, she's 12.
I'm Isabella. I'm in 8th grade, and I go to Chippewa Junior High. Well, my voice teacher is Kelly Stubel. Shout out to you. She came up to me one day, and she was like, there's this cool audition that you should go to, and they're looking for a girl that looks just like you, and I think you would be good for the role. And I was debating whether to go to the audition or not, because I had school, and I had to do homework and stuff. And then I decided to go, and now I'm here, and I'm really glad I made that decision.
What was on the list of, when they were looking for Zoe, what was on that list of things you had to do?
Well, they wanted her to be of like a more minority race, and I'm Latina, and then they wanted her to be like, they wanted her to be around the ages of 8 and 7, but then 12, 13 would be fine too. They wanted someone that really had a high range, like a diverse range. So his songs are very rangy, I guess you could say.
And there's also the ability to play a red something. What is that something?
A red guitar.
So you play guitar?
I learned this summer how to play guitar.
Really? How long did that take?
It took a really long time. I've been working for like 4 months now, 5 months maybe. And it's one of the harder instruments that I've had to play because I play the piano. I played it for 3 years. But the guitar, you actually have to go through physical pain, like with your fingers, like burning when you play, when you press down on the strings really hard. But it's a fun instrument once you get used to it.
What parts of Zoe do you see in yourself?
She's very bold, and she's very unique, and she doesn't care about what anyone thinks about her, and she breaks all kinds of stereotypes, and I see that in me too.
Writing the music and lyrics for Isabella Grace Olivo's Princess Zoe in the Riverwalk Theater's production of The Princess Who Saved Herself, opening this Friday, is Edric Haleen. Now, Edric, in terms of writing a musical based on another art form, I mean, for example, Sunday in the Park with George, that was based on the Pointillist painting by Georges Seurat, but Sondheim and Lapine didn't have to ask the Seurat estate whether they could write a musical, since the painting was public domain. And for The Princess Who Saved Herself, that's a bit different because the original songwriter, Jonathan Colton, he's still around, he owns the copyright. Does that provide like a bit of a challenge for you? Has Mr. Colton given his blessing on the show?
Absolutely. I didn't start writing until I communicated with him, and I've actually communicated with his assistant, Scarface. And if you're not a Jonathan Colton fan, then in the song Skullcrusher Mountain, you will learn about Scarface, and this is a real thing now. But yes, I said, you know, can I have permission to do this? And I've been in contact with him through the various, when the script was finished, I sent it to him for his perusal. When the songs were finished, I sent the lyrics so that he could see it. And I
demos as well?
I never sent demos. But I've kept him apprised all the way along, and I've also invited him to come see it. But when I invited him the first time, Scarface said, well, he's likely to be touring with Amy Mann on a Christmas tour at that time. And I don't think Amy Mann has a Christmas tour right now, but he's in New York, he's busy, he's on public radio. So if he comes, great, but that's fine.
On the surface of it, this is being marketed for the most part towards a younger audience, but I'm assuming, since it is geek rock nerdcore, that there are multiple levels going on.
Yes, every good children's show, Disney films and children's theater and whatever, always plays on multiple levels so that the grown-ups who drive the kids to the movie theater or to the stage theater aren't bored out of their gourds. This one probably plays that in spades simply because the source material is Jonathan Colton. So yes, there will be things for the kids. Yes, there will be things for the grown-ups. Yes, there will also be things for all the Jonathan Colton fans and the nerds and the geeks who come out. All of the math, all of the science will be accurate, and there's a good chunk of it. I mean, 7 minutes into the show, we've finished the opening sequence. We finished the opening number, and we've already explored the mechanics of transverse waves. We've already explored the mathematics of the Mandelbrot set. We've already used our imagination for, you know, what life would be like if we were a giant. And it's very carefully written so that if you're not a huge math geek, you're not going to be lost. It's not crucial to your understanding or enjoyment of the show that you know amplitude and wavelength and frequency and the astronomical mechanics of a total solar eclipse and all of this stuff. It's enough that you understand that Zoe gets it.
Edric Colleen's The Princess Who Saved Herself, based on the song by Jonathan Colton, opens Friday night and runs through Sunday, December 4th at the Riverwalk Theater in downtown Lansing. More information at riverwalktheater.com. For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
There was a castle by a waterfall with a pink and purple wall and a princess living there. She had no parents and was
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, Dr. Temple Grandin is one of the foremost animal welfare experts in the world. She did not speak until she was 3.5 years old. On a visit to the Lansing area, I'll talk with the woman sometimes called the best-known person with autism in the world about her work on behalf of people with autism and her animal welfare renown. Plus, for Neighbors in Action, we'll check in with the Refugee Development Center in Lansing to find out what's new with that organization. That and more tomorrow on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Katie Cook directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and to Drew Hill. The Current State podcast, anywhere, anytime, at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.